The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I think that this time of year I'm supposed to give inspiring talks. but I won't. I think. We'll see how it goes. But I want to talk about renunciation. But not just renunciation and loss. And there's a correlation, a connection between the Buddhist practice and understanding of renunciation and that of the basic human loss that everyone sooner or later will experience, more likely sooner. So renunciation is... you get a sense, a little bit, of its maybe power, significance, and kind of the tenor of it, at least in the Buddhist context, by looking at what it's associated with. In one list of practices, it's associated with things like generosity, truth, wisdom, loving kindness, equanimity, kind of all kind of wonderful things. So it's in that category, wonderfulness. Even though it doesn't sound that way, maybe. Another place, renunciation is put together with compassion and kindness, and in the list of this of right intention. So those are things that are kind of associated with it, which I think are seen as good things. And instead of using the word renunciation, use the English word simplification. Many people would say, oh yeah, that's great. Someone says, I want to simplify my life. Oh, yeah, that sounds good. I wish I could, or something. Someone is going to do exactly the same thing, go through the same motions, same activities, and say, I'm going to renounce some things. Oh, okay. I'm sorry to hear that. And I wonder your sanity. There might be something unhealthy about what's going on here. And I think there's often a very strong reaction in English around this word renunciation. And maybe it's appropriate given maybe how it's used sometimes in the Western world, Western context. But you have to remember that it's a translation of a Buddhist word. And so, in Buddhism it has different connotations than in English. What I like about the English word renunciation is its Latin roots. The re part, prefix means again, and nunciation means to speak up, to say. And I think it originally comes from the idea of a ceremony, a public ritual, where someone announces their choice to go into the religious life. And in doing that, they're leaving behind a lot of, their ordinary life and activities. And in doing so, it's a big step for some people. They give up, in a religious life, oftentimes giving up their sexual life, giving up maybe their wealth, their money, their homes, maybe a lot of the relationships they have, maybe their the image they have of themselves, about how they are in society. Many things are given up. And but it is a kind of what I like about it is the idea that it's an announcement in a sense that it's a choice. It's something someone chooses to do in a conscious, clear way, as opposed to letting go or giving up, which might not be even consciously done. It's like we say I let go, or eventually it let go or it fell away or something, and that was great. But there's certain maturity associated with making a conscious choice, and hopefully wisdom in having that kind of sense of autonomy and strength to be able to do that. And there is a monk named Ajahn Amaro who once wrote an article that was titled, I don't know if he made the title, the editors of the magazine made the title, that I think is a kind of a take on an old commercial. Some of you are old enough to remember this commercial, perhaps. Maybe I won't say it. But monks have more fun. And monks, Buddhist monks, you know, are representatives of this movement of conscious renunciation, and they give up a lot of what people think is fun and wonderful in life. They give up sex, and they give up a lot of recreation, listening to music. They give up a lot and lots of things. And so it seems like it could be a drag. It seems like it could be pretty dull and boring. In fact, when I was ordained as a Zen monk, as a Zen priest, it was a kind of public ceremony in 1982, and my parents came to the ceremony, and my father, after the ceremony, went up to the abbot who had ordained me and said, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about my son, and because I'm concerned his life is not going to be boring. And that was his biggest concern. I was going to have a boring life. My father sails all over the oceans of the world, and he thinks life is about having adventures. So you know, his idea of being a monk was like, oh, you don't. That's it for your adventures. And whereas for me, the degree to which I lived a renunciate life, went to Burma and was a monastic, I would say was the happiest, most continuously happy period of my life. Maybe I was by disposition suited for kind of monastic life, renunciant life. So it was easier for me than it is for a lot of people. It was really, I felt more happy in a continuous, nonstop kind of way in that kind of life, especially when I was a monk in Burma. Not so much because I was a monk, but rather because of being able to delve deeply into meditation. I was on meditation retreat for 8 months, and to be able to kind of have that level of kind of simplification, engagement with practice, just brought me a tremendous sense of joy and well-being. And so in our tradition, the Vipassana tradition, we're kind of a retreat tradition where we put a lot of emphasis or value on going on meditation retreats. And so we all said, you know, at our retreat center, the title of retreat says, you know, insight retreat, 7-day insight retreat with so-and-so. Some people, that's the title. And insight and mindfulness is kind of popular these days, it's trendy. So all kinds of people will sign up and think it's a nice idea. And one of the examples of it, maybe how it's popular, is there was one person that came a few years ago to one of our retreats, and the person introduced herself as a... I think she said, I wrote a book on mindfulness. I teach mindfulness in some kind of corporate level. And then she said, but this is the first time I'm going to meditate. And I said, oh, first time on retreat? No, first time to meditate. So, you know, so mindfulness now can be associated with other things besides meditation and being on retreat, which, you know, in our scene, I think is much more the association. And so it's good, nice. People come, you know, to our innocent little title, Insight Retreat for 7 days. We could just as well have titled it Renunciation Retreat. Come and be celibate for 7 days. What if we titled it even Celibacy Retreat? Would we be popular? Would people come? And but renunciation retreat. You know, you come and you kind of give up your own schedule. You give up your sleeping in the morning. You give up eating what you want to eat, but you have to kind of eat what's given to you mostly. You give up your active sex life. People often don't give up their fantasies on retreat. But you know, their active sex life is given up, and you know, there's a giving up of social conversations, and people are silent for the time. People give up the comforts of their own home, and at our retreat center are given a little room, single room. It's, I don't know, how big is it? Maybe 10 by 12. Is that reasonable size? Those of you who have been there? A little room. It has a little sink. Some of them have. And what? Oh, you give up your... Maybe you shouldn't have said that. No, I mean, sex, that's okay, but but iPhones. Oh. And I think it's hard to give up these phones because I get the sense we're supposed to, when people sign up for our retreats, they have to apply. They have to check off a box saying that they're not going to use their devices. But occasionally people still do. They come to interviews and say, oh, yeah, you know, I checked. I said, what? We just talked about not doing it. And even agreed. And the only thing I can figure out, my best guess theory about this, is that it's so integral to, it's like breathing. And so, yes, they've given up their, what they thought cell phones were kind of, well, they're giving up something. But it's inconceivable you'd give up your, you know, something about the checking the phone or something. So that's more difficult than sex. And for at least, for some people, perhaps. And then there's a kind of renunciation of money for the time, 7 days without having to touch your wallet and money, your credit card. And it's a very different life. And some people, when it's their first retreat, will find it challenging. It's very challenging to step out of their ordinary life and ordinary circumstances and comforts of home and food and relationships and all kinds of things. I think it's fair to say that the majority of the people who do it, by the end of it, really appreciate it a lot and look forward to it next time. And they look forward to it, they still don't think about their doing renunciation. I don't know what they think, but, you know, the simplification. You know, it's so nice to be simple and not have a lot of the pressures and demands of life and responsibilities that we have to do. And to really be able to spend time to kind of be, because of that, to be focused internally with oneself, be really connect with oneself, but not to be self-preoccupied, but really the opposite. There's a wonderful way which we start paying attention carefully what's going on here. Sometimes for some people, the first time, And we start seeing the limitations of being self-centered and self-preoccupied. And there's a kind of turning inside out or kind of dropping away of the kind of selfishness that sometimes is invisible when we don't renounce, when we just kind of keep pursuing what we want and what you know, all these things in our world. So some people find it very satisfying, very meaningful. I don't know if they always find it joyful or happy exactly, but often very deeply healing, very sane, a wonderful thing to do. So we have this example of retreats that are an event of renunciation. But please don't tell people that. That's just for you to know. But also meditation is a little bit that. And also we don't think of meditation this way as well. But in meditation, you know, if you meditate for 45 minutes, you put aside all kinds of things in your life. And we don't think of it as renunciation because it's just temporary. Just for this, you don't even think it's temporary. You just, if you go and brush your teeth, you don't think you're renouncing anything. But while you're brushing your teeth, you're probably not having sex and probably not, having your meal and probably not watching, TV, but maybe I'm wrong. People bring their phones with them into the bathroom. So we sit down to meditate in 45 minutes. There's a renunciation of many of the common things. And it's interesting to go through the list of things which are put aside. Put aside concern with food, concern with things involved with social relationship with other people. You might have thoughts like that, but you're not actively involved. You've put aside use of money, put aside use of entertainment, put aside your roles that you live by. You might have all kinds of roles and self-images that are important for you, identities that are very important. And to some degree, those roles, this image you want to live by, how you see yourself, is put aside for that time. You might put aside your concern for the relationships you're in your life. They're important for you, but for those times in meditating, you feel like, I keep thinking about this person, this is not the time for it, and so you learn to let go of it and simplify your mind. And the more simple and more concentrated and more still the mind can become, the more things, in a sense, have been put aside. More things that we're preoccupied and involved in life. And it's quite phenomenal to get the mind very, very still and peaceful and have a sense of well-being and peace that's not dependent on any of the things of the world that usually our well-being is dependent on, the usual things we're preoccupied with. And so people start feeling the benefits of this radical simplicity of mind, where desires and aversions, resentments, past and future, are put aside for this time, the simplification. And it's for some people, it's a sea change in their life to discover a sense of well-being that they've never known before, that is not dependent on getting what they want in the world. Not depending on their relationships or their job or their house or their home or their car or their entertainment or their status, or maybe even it's not dependent on their security and their safety in that moment of sitting there. That's not kind of what's, you know, a concern that's operating. So both these retreats, which are a kind of renunciation, a kind of simplification, and meditation, which can be even more radical simplification, teaches people a different way of being in the world, a different thing. And some people will come out of retreats and out of meditation and say, I think I want to be finished with things. Some people come out of retreat specially and really want to be done with certain kinds of behaviors which they've been doing, that they feel, this doesn't really serve me anymore. People who meditate sometimes will make a decision, I think I'm done with this. One of the ones that often happens, I hear lately in kind of this work environment of, I don't know if it's unique to Silicon Valley area, but people will say, I don't want to gossip anymore. At the coffee machine at work, or, talking, socially at work, there's a lot of talking about people and gossiping. And that's kind of the currency of how we have relationships there. And it's hard not to gossip, but I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. There's a choice. And if they tell me, they're announcing it. And they're telling me what they've already decided, so they're announcing it again. It's an act of renunciation. I would like to stop doing this. And I'm telling you because it's important for me and I'm maybe struggling with this. Sometimes people's ethics change and they renounce certain behavior which they think is unethical. There are people for whom come and talk to me who have worked at companies that are suppliers or working for the defense industry, and they, after a while, they realize, I don't know if I can do this anymore. This doesn't make any sense. Not appropriate for me. Or people who've had professions where lying was part of the profession. I remember the first time someone came, not to me, but I was with another teacher, and the person came to the teacher and said, in my profession, we're expected to lie. And how can I be a Buddhist and lie at the same time? And the person asked the question in all sincerity. And the teacher said, in all sincerity, you can't. So that was interesting. So some people feel like they want to renounce or give up or avoid certain behaviors because they know something better. And they kind of like having a clean cloth, you don't want to get the cloth dirty again. So having a clean mind, a simple mind, you don't want to make it dirty again. Some people will give up a lot of television watching. That's a fairly common one. People come back and from retreat and say, no more. And then some people will come and tell me, after that retreat, I decided no more TV. Or I didn't even decide, I just didn't. And that lasted for about 2 months. And then it crept back, and then I stopped meditating. And now I'm coming back on retreat again, so that I can kind of reset myself and try to get, I really don't want to keep doing this lifestyle. And some people use retreats as a tool, as a means to reset themselves and to kind of help them with this, maybe the safer word is to say this simplification, this avoidance of behavior which they don't feel like they want to do anymore, this renunciation. So in Buddhism, the word for renunciation, the Pali word, the Buddhist word, is nekama, the ancient Indian word. And the connotations of the word, or the etymology of the word, is very different than this English renunciation. It has more the meaning of to go forth, to go out. And some of you know that the nice example I like to use for this is that you're holed up in a mountain cabin in the snow all winter long, one-room cabin, with all your relatives. And maybe you love all your relatives, but, you know, 3-4 months of winter snowed in a one-room cabin without being able to go out. As you know, it gets to be a little bit of a challenge or claustrophobic after a while. And then finally spring comes and the snow melts and you're able to get out the door and out into the natural world. And it just feels so great to go forth, go out. And this sense of joy and expansiveness and openness and to possibilities is a little bit more the feeling of the Pali word nekama. And in fact, becoming a monastic is called in Buddhism going forth. And it's going forth, and, you know, maybe it's not completely the connotations. Nice to hear this for the way we relate to our domestic life. But the domestic life used to be called dusty and confining. And so you go forth out of the dusty and confined domestic life. And out into the open. So the idea is that renunciation is not a deprivation, but rather an enhancement of the person. We're not necessarily so much giving up as we're gaining. And so to the flip side of renunciation, you know, there's something we're giving up or avoiding or simplifying from doing, but there's also benefits from them. And so it's not a rejection of the world, of things, so much, unless they're unethical or harming. But it isn't so much a rejection of them as it is appreciating that it's beneficial to no longer do them anymore. That not doing them opens up new possibilities. And some of the things that people renounce are not bad things. I think everyone who lives a wise life has to decide at some point to choose between all the different options that are nice things to do. You can't do all the nice things that come along, especially in our society where there's just so many things, you know, advertisements and shows and things and TV shows and, I don't know, just lots of opportunities. If you want to live a wise life, you have to not chase out every nice, pleasant opportunity that's there, but there has to be some kind of maybe simplifying or choosing and that has to go along. So sometimes we naturally will renounce, avoid things that are actually healthy and good, not because we're rejecting them, but because we know that we can't do it all and we're better off doing some things. So the idea that renunciation is for our betterment. It's an interesting little poem by the Buddha where he said that a wise person gives up a lesser happiness for a greater happiness. That's a very evocative idea, that you have something good, you're happy in something, but maybe if you can get even happier, you would let go of that as well. And one of the happy options is renunciation. And the simplification, this ability to practice deeply, perhaps. And as I'm repeating myself, you know, some of the happiest times of my life in a consistent, continuous way has been when I was living a renunciant life as a monastic or long retreats. And the degree of happiness and joy and pleasure that I felt in that life was just astounding and wonderful and quite something. So, I said this talk would be about renunciation and loss. On Friday, I heard someone give a talk where he listed he was mostly talking about loss in the context of people who end up in a hospital. And when people are hospitalized, there's often loss involved, and they have to deal with that loss, even if it's temporary. sometimes it's permanent. And then someone said, yeah, this list that he gave also applies to people who are incarcerated and other situations in life. So these five losses, and these are the five losses that chaplains, hospital chaplains, are attending to when they meet with people in a hospital. It's not the job of a doctor to tend to people's ordinary kind of psychological losses so much, but it is a job of the hospital chaplain or the prison chaplain to tune into this, pay attention to this, because often that's a huge, huge issue for people. And these five losses are not just relevant for hospitals or prisons, but also in everyday life. These are kinds of losses that, significant losses many people can have. So there's the loss of relationships. So people die, people move away, they're no longer in our lives for some reason. People get hospitalized, or you know, the people aren't visiting so much, and maybe not accessible, and so we're alone, and the ordinary relationships we have and are not there so much. And maybe if there's someone you see every day, that maybe they still come visit you, but you're alone. There's the loss of roles. People's role in life. Some people are very identified with a role. It's very important for them. And so people retire and their role is not there. And it's going to be very difficult for some people. Some people celebrate, can't wait. There's a role of being a parent. And a child dies or a child grows up and moves out. And some parents find that there's an ongoing series of grieving as parents and celebrating as kids grow up, because how we are as a parent changes as we go along. And so what was so fun and enjoyable to do when they were young for them, care for them, we can't do that anymore. They don't want us to do it anymore. And so you know, it can be the role changes, and so the changing roles. And someone's hospitalized, many of their roles in their life, their work roles, their family roles, their place in the family, their role in their local community, for the time temporarily, is just not there, not operating, and they, you know, and people in the hospital don't know who they are and couldn't care less that they were a CEO or something else. You're just a person sitting there in a hospital gown. And so there's loss of roles that happens, and people get sick and they lose their roles. People get injured or have a disability and they can no longer fulfill all kinds of roles they had that were important for them. There's the role of a person's image, self-identity, how they see themselves. And there's a gap now. My image is to be this way, and I can't do this way anymore in the world. And the identity of themselves, so I'm no longer there. There's a loss of functionality. People lose the ability, physical functioning, mental functioning, all kinds of functions that they've used to having. They can't do. They're in the hospital, they're bedridden, they're injured, and they can't get up and go out and do whatever they want. In prison, the same things. People get injured and live a life. Their life is radically different, and maybe with a disability, or people get older. And it's for most people, aging involves a decrease of functionality. Stamina, physical abilities of all kinds, mental abilities of different kinds. And so if our identity and our relationships were dependent on our functionality, how we function, how we could do things, and we can no longer function at the level we did before, then things begin to shift and change. I talked to someone recently who spent much of his life being an athlete, playing on different teams and different things. And then he realized he doesn't have the stamina and ability to keep up with it. He can't do it anymore. And a big, huge part of what his life was about no longer is there because he can't quite function what's needed. And then there's material loss, that people lose their homes or lose their material objects and things in many different ways. I've had friends who lost their homes in fires. One friend who went off to the beach with her car keys, car and driver's license, and towel, and came home, and her house was burnt in the Oakland fire. And everything, her office was her home. So everything disappeared. And we know, probably some of you know people who lost their homes in the Northern California fires. There were thousands of people, thousands of homes that were burnt down the, up there, and with almost no ability to kind of, some places, to take the things out of the home. And so they lost all these family mementos and photographs of the kids growing up, and they were so meaningful, and just material loss. So much was lost. So much was lost. And so then there's grief. There's anger, sadness. There's all kinds of, you know, it's very, can sit very heavy on the heart to have these kinds of emotions. And part of many people's lives is working, practicing with their grief, their sadness, their loss, all these different kinds of losses that go on. Sometimes it's slow and gradual. Sometimes it's sudden and dramatic. And but sooner or later, if you're a mindfulness practitioner, you're going to have to apply your mindfulness practice to the experience of loss. Because sooner or later, you'll experience, if not some of these losses, all five of them. If you live, if you're fortunate enough to live to an old age, chances are you'll lose all of them as you go along. And so how do we practice with it? How do we relate to it? What's the relevance of practice to these kinds of loss? So what I'd like to suggest, in a way that's maybe provocative for you to reflect on and think about, is that there's a lot of similarities between renunciation and loss. A loss is imposed on us. It's not our choice. We don't want it. Renunciation is a choice. Renunciation involves a degree of autonomy, capacity, hopefully wisdom, to make a decision to put aside, simplify, let go of certain things in our lives, to no longer have our lives dependent on certain things or our well-being tied up in those things, to be able to move into a different place, different way of well-being and peace that's not so dependent on so many of the things that people are often dependent on and preoccupied with. So what if, on one hand, renunciation can involve a letting go of the of relationships, letting go of roles, letting go of identity and images, self-image, letting go of functionalities, and letting go of our material world that we have, our possessions. Perhaps a renunciant, someone who does this practice, even if they don't think they're going to be a renunciant or renounce, as we do this practice, go deeper and deeper in this practice, we are, in fact, learning how to let go of all these things, even if we still have them. Even if we come back to them and live with them in a wise way, even if we haven't let go of them, we learn how to have a peace or a well-being where we become independent from them. Is the loss, when there's sadness and grief, which is genuine, I don't want to diminish the importance of those feelings, but does the is there a new perspective that can be brought to the losses we have? Is it only a matter of processing the grief? It's only a matter of kind of being sad and going through grief, kind of stages of grief that goes on? Or is there other ways of looking at loss and what's behind the loss and what our relationship to the things that we lost? Other way of looking at what goes on inside of ourselves, what we're holding on to, what we've been dependent on, and what we think we need for our happiness or security, safety, something, when there's a loss that Buddhist practice kind of points to and maybe inspires and points to some other way or other perspective of how to be with this. So, for example, if people you know, people lose a spouse who dies. And on the surface, I don't know how to say this exactly, it seems like on the surface, it's like this is tragic, it's sad to have that. And we feel sorry for people, or maybe it's, you know, something. But I've been in conversations with people where I try to, at some point, to explore what is it that's so hard about losing a spouse. And sometimes what's hard was not losing the relationship, but losing the security that came, losing the breadwinner, losing the status or the relationships that came with being associated with that person, the circle of friends that came along with that person, and now the circle of friends has changed, and people are not so interested in, you know, because it turned out there was the spouse's friends or something. And so it gets more, you know, look into it, it gets more complicated, all the things that, what was associated, what the meaning, what was meaningful and important in that, you know, in that loss. And so our material well-being, what our possessions, what do they mean for us? You know, what are we really holding on to when we hold on to things? Image, self-identity. What are we, if we're holding on and there's loss of it and we're grieving it, what was it we're holding on to? What was the nature of the holding? What were we attached to? What were the beliefs that were operating? Can we look more deeply? And is there something about the simplification, the radical letting go, the renunciation that a Buddhist practice points to as a possibility that prepares us for loss, the inevitable losses? And that's one of the kind of really, I feel, important things the practice has done for me, is that I've had loss in my life. And now I'm getting older, and I feel my functionality changing in all kinds of ways. My stamina is not what it was, and all kinds of things are. Some people call it indignities. Is it? You know, maybe I've already let go. So, okay. Okay, this too. And, you know, it's a very, you know, or not be surprised. Oh yeah, yep, I guess it's that time. That's what it comes to now, as opposed to, oh no, how could this be? This is a travesty, as opposed to, oh, yep, I guess so. So to have the Buddhist practice be a preparation for the losses that are going to be inevitable, it doesn't mean that you're going to be happy and joyful by everything that you lose, but it might change your understanding of it. It might offer support. And what I find is that with some of the losses, like for people who die in my life, that I feel it quite acutely. My heart gets broken in that experience. And I think that in some ways I feel the sadness, in a sense, more fully than I did when I was younger. I have capacity to feel more deeply. But it's uncomplicated grief and sadness. There's a kind of clean aspect of it. It just kind of penetrates, pierces sharply, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't come with a lot of other baggage and other needs that I have and attachments I have, and it doesn't come with a lot of secondary losses that's so important that I think is, you know, and it's these secondary losses perhaps that are not really directly, you know, related to the person that has more to do with our attachments or something. So, what is your relationship to loss? Maybe you're sitting here in this today with some significant loss that you're processing and working with, and I want to be very, very respectful of that, and caring of it. And you're sitting in a religious tradition that puts in a central place appreciation of the value and the benefits of letting go, of simplifying, at least simplifying psychologically. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to simplify the things of our life and change our relationships and stuff, but to let go deeply in our minds so that our hearts are not dependent, well-being of our hearts is not dependent on those things. We know a deeper kind of peace. So I like to think of that when people let go, in a healthy way, when people renounce in a healthy way, the consequence of that is joy, a kind of a lightening up. And if there isn't some kind of becoming lighter, some kind of well-being, we kind of move towards the light, in a sense, move towards some sense of this is healthy, move towards health, then perhaps you haven't really understood what it is to let go. Or maybe you've let go of the wrong thing. And some understanding that you benefit as a result of this, even though it might be hard to do. So, this is the season. It's still getting darker and darker. And we're supposed to inspire people and with light and cheer people up. And so maybe I didn't today. And it's a wonderful time, this kind of, there's a kind of letting go and coming inwards and simplifying with the season getting darker and darker. And so we have a few more weeks of this. So why don't you take advantage of the season and figure out how you can become so much happier and a better person if you can just renounce some things. So as it gets darker, just renounce. And then that way, when it comes to the solstice and it starts getting lighter again, it'll be like you're ready to go forth, go out into the open light and open space and be lighter and clear and freer. So prepare yourself for the solstice by letting go. May you enjoy it. Thank you.